Well, you probably should do that. Okay, good morning, good morning, good morning. So the next two lectures will be given by Professor Sidney Hemming. And Professor Hemming received her PhD from SUNY Stony Brook in geology. And she came to Columbia to do a postdoc, and she never left. This was 2 years ago, after 2 years, rather, of her postdoc, she was appointed to the faculty. Her curriculum vitae has an impressive list of publications and grants and teaching activities, but knowing Sid as I do, this doesn't surprise me. I know she's a talented teacher and she's a talented researcher. What really surprised me about this curriculum vitae and also made me very jealous is where she does her research. Now, to put this in perspective, since I work in the visual system, I've spent 40 years in basements without windows because they figure we need to control light, so we don't need light, so they put us in the basement. On the other hand, she's done her research in the following places. On a boat going from Lisbon to Cardiff, on a boat from Dubain to Cape Town, on a boat in the Greenland fjords, and on land in mountains, deserts, and lakes in Mexico, Appalachia, Wyoming, New Mexico, Minnesota, and, as you'll learn next week, Mono Lake in Nevada. And don't miss the lecture next week because she's going to talk, not only show you pictures of Mono Lake, but she's going to talk to you about the research she does there. But today we're going to hear, well, see, there's another picture to make me envious. You do research there too?
It's on purpose.
So today we're going to hear about climate system. Professor Hemming.
Thank you. Well, actually, we as geologists, we live for field work, and we definitely want to collect as many beautiful spots on the world that we've been to as possible. But I actually do spend a lot of time in the lab as well, unfortunately. But the data are very exciting once they come out. This is a place that's not very far from Mono Lake. It's called Convict Lake in California. It's actually quite close to Mammoth Lakes. So what I'm going to start with today is a couple of demonstrations that are you know, not winds and water and so forth of the climate system, but are hopefully meant to sort of get you started on the ideas about some of the things about the climate system that make it a little bit complicated to study, but fascinating nonetheless. So I'm going to start with this first prop. This is Lucky Lizzie, the dinosaur. And I'm going to put Lucky Lizzie on the table. And this demonstration is to indicate the concept of thresholds in the climate system. And so I'm going to start out, I'm just going to push Lizzie 1 inch, and Lizzie's going to move 1 inch. I'm going to push Lizzie another inch, and Lizzie's going to move an inch. Push Lizzie an inch, and Lizzie moves an inch. Push Lizzie an inch, and Lizzie moves an inch. Push Lizzie an inch, and Lizzie moves an inch. Push Lizzie an inch. Oh, Lizzie fell off the table. So this is an example of thresholds. I kept changing the system. I pushed Lizzie an inch, and Lizzie moved an inch. And then finally, I got to a spot where I crossed a threshold, and Lizzie fell off the table. And this is one of the things that we think it might be the sort of physical process that works to enhance the forcing in the climate system that might be the sort of thing that leads towards these rapid climate changes in Greenland, like Wally Broker showed you diagrams of last time. And I'm going to show you one other demonstration to indicate something about the complexity of the climate system. Now, you may have all seen clocks that work as pendulums. Pendulums are move back and forth in a very regular, one might say, like clockwork manner. But I've got this demonstration. It's an extremely precisely machined set of two pendulums with little arms sticking on the bottom of them. They rotate freely on this rod that I'm holding. And they're machined to be precisely exactly the same as each other. So I'm going to hook these pendulums up to my stool and hopefully don't run into the legs this time. Okay, and then I'm going to take these two pendulums and I'm going to hold them up exactly the same height as each other. And then I'm going to let them go. They don't act the same as each other at all, right? It's not predictable how they're going to react relative to each other. And I can do this, and I can try to be extremely precise about holding it up and make it exactly the same each time, and they're never going to act the same as each other. So this is one of the things that's complicated about the climate system. It's a bit analogous to the in-body problem that Katherine Johnson told you about, and that is that the physical principles that govern the climate system are actually quite simple. But there's a lot of physical principles governing the climate system, and they interact with each other, and it's that complex network of interactions that causes the climate system to be very difficult to predict. But first, I just want to start by giving a little tour of what the climate is in different places. So how many of you have been to Central Park? I see some people that didn't raise their hands. I don't know whether they're shy or just didn't go to Central Park. If you haven't been there, you really should go. It's beautiful. But anyway, in Central Park, you probably noticed that the weather is changing now, and it's getting colder, and the leaves are changing colors. And so this is a sort of a typical photograph of what Central Park looks like in October. And in October, the average temperature is 57.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and the average rainfall is 3.5 inches. In January, the temperature is close to freezing, and the average precipitation, whether it be rain or snow, is about 3.7 inches. In April, the average temperature is 52.5 degrees, and the average rainfall is 3.2 inches. And in July, the average temperature is 76.8 degrees, and the average rainfall is 4.2 inches. So New York is located on the east coast of North America at about 41 degrees, and this is a map of the world. And for reference, I've labeled the positions of the continents, North America, South America, Africa, Europe, Asia, Indian subcontinent, Australia, and Antarctica. I don't know whether you watch the Today Show or not, but last week, the Today Show was actually going to the extremes of the Earth or the ends of the Earth or something like that. And Ann Curry, the person on the Today Show that reads the news, went to Antarctica. I'm jealous about that. And she actually got to go to the South Pole after many days of attempting to go to the South Pole. She ended up getting to go to the South Pole. So she went to the ceremonial South Pole, which is a little stick sticking up out of the ice. And she walked around the South Pole and said, "You want to see me go all the way around the Earth once?" So that brings me to the point that this projection in the southern and northern high latitudes, the area that you would be able to walk around in 1 second is represented by a large range on the map. And so this is a projection. There are many different types of map projections, but it exaggerates the area of the high latitudes relative to the low latitudes. And I'm also going to label on this map Greenland. Greenland's not a continent, it's an island, but it's a large island, and it's really important in the climate system. It's covered by ice, and that's important in the climate system. And in addition to that, it's the record of the cores through the ice in Greenland that has provided one of the most compelling records of climate change that we have. Okay, and so I'm going to move down south from New York to Miami. How many of you have been to Miami? I chose that because it's a good spring break place, and I figured a lot of people might have been there. And how many of you have been to Panama? Yeah, well, oh, I see one. That's great. Well, I haven't been to Panama. I have never been to the tropics, I realized as I was putting this together. So I that's one of the things I have to figure out how to do. But anyway, so if we move down to Miami, in October, the average temperature is 78.3 degrees. Remember, that's about what July was in Central Park. The average rainfall is 6.2 inches. In January, the average temperature is 67.2 degrees, and the average rainfall is 1.9 inches. I got these off the web, and by the way, I use the same four for Miami because it really doesn't change very much throughout the way it looks doesn't change very much. You don't get the beautiful fall colors and spring flowers and so forth. And in April, the average temperature is 65.2 degrees, and the average rainfall is 3.4 inches. And in July, the average temperature is 82.6 degrees, and the average rainfall is 5.8 inches. So New York is at about 41 degrees north, Miami is at about 20 degrees north, and Panama is at about 10 degrees north. In October in Panama, the average temperature is 82 degrees, and the average rainfall is 22 inches. In January, the average temperature is 82 degrees, and the average rainfall is 3.5 inches. In April, the average temperature is 82 degrees. It's getting a little monotonous, right? And the average rainfall is less than an inch. And in July, the average temperature is 82 degrees, and the average rainfall is 22 inches. So if we look at these three places together, in New York City, the average temperature range is, the average temperature range is 46 degrees for these 4 months that I picked out. The average precipitation range is 1 inch. In Miami, the average temperature range is more modest. It's about 16 degrees Fahrenheit in these 4 months. And the average precipitation range is larger, about 4.3 inches. And if we go down to Panama, there's basically no range in temperature, but there's an enormous range in the rainfall throughout the course of the year, 21 inches. Okay, so last lecture, Wally Broecker showed you that fossil fuel burning is changing the atmosphere composition by adding carbon dioxide through fossil fuel burning. And he also pointed out that the climate system response to small nudges can be great, much like Lizzie falling off the table. And he urged us to consider the fact that humans must face the challenge of sustaining the habitable environment of our planet while still maintaining a high quality of living. So I'm going to continue with the theme of climate. And as a geologist, my goal in climate research is to understand past climates on the Earth. And so my two lectures are motivated by the dual need to understand the present. And one of the adages of geology is the present is the key to the past. And the other is the recognition that in order to be able to understand the climate at any one place, we can't measure temperature and rainfall. And even if we find a proxy that's good at measuring temperature and rainfall, we have to be aware that we're in one spot in the Earth and maybe we're not actually measuring the temperature and rainfall in the season that we'd be most like to measure the temperature and rainfall. So a really huge effort in paleoclimate research is and has to be the development of proxies to better understand aspects about the climate system. So that'll be my topic for next week. But today we're going to talk about the present climate system. And the question is, the big question is, what regulates climate? And a more interesting sort of rewording of the question is that relates back to Wally's point that the climate system is capable of making large adjustments to small changes. How can small changes in forcing result in large changes in climate? And that's the angry climate piece from Wally Broecker. So the first order is the global energy balance, and we'll discuss that. The fact is that the energy on the surface of the Earth is not evenly distributed. You can sort of see that from the contrast between New York, Miami, and Panama already. The climate system responds with feedbacks to the energy that's coming in from the sun and particularly the uneven distribution of that. And the climate system responses and feedbacks affect the energy balance through reflection and absorption feedbacks and the energy redistribution via circulation by the atmosphere and oceans. And so we're going to talk about these various aspects in a simple way about the climate system. So first of all, what is climate? Well, I just showed you three places in the world where the answer would be very, very different. But on a global scale, the global climate is an average temperature on Earth. And today on our Earth, the temperature is about 15 degrees centigrade or 59 degrees Fahrenheit. And so a first-order question, a fundamental question that we need to answer in order to understand how we might be changing climate is, why is it like that? So it's all about the sun. The sun is all of the energy from the climate system comes from the sun. There is a lot of internal energy within the Earth, and it's very important for driving mountain building and volcanoes and so forth, but it's insignificant to the climate system. So it's about a factor of 10,000 less energy coming to the surface of the Earth from the Earth than it is from the sun. And the global energy balance is based on how much of the sun's radiation is actually absorbed on the surface, that is, not reflected back into space. And it's also the blanketing effect of the atmosphere that adds warmth to the surface of the Earth. So the three important things that you need to know, the take-home message is, the sun is the source, reflection sends some of the radiation back out into space acting to cool the Earth, and the atmosphere absorbs Earth radiation acting to warm the Earth. Okay, so the sun is about 6,000 degrees centigrade, and it's about 150 million kilometers away from the Earth. And so this diagram, which you've seen before in the astronomy section, shows the influence of increasing distance on decreasing energy. And so if you look in the center here, the star is our little sun, and the d equals 1, d equals 2, and d equals 3 are the distances, hypothetical distances away from that star. And the nested spheres are the spheres that have the radius that is the distance away from the star. And then the little window-looking things, you can see the cone shape radiating out from our point source star. The little windows are the amount of energy intercepted at or proportional to the amount of energy intercepted per unit area. And so in the first one, you have this one square at d equals 1. If you double the distance to d equals 2, the amount of area that's covered by that same amount of energy is 4 times bigger, and therefore the energy per unit area is 4 times less. And then if you triple the distance away, the amount of area that's covered is 9 times greater, and therefore the energy per unit area is 9 times less. So that's the distance effect. In addition to that, the heating at the surface of the Earth from the sun is not even. And that's because of two things. One of them is that the rays from the sun are more perpendicular in the tropics and at a lower angle to the surface of the Earth in the high latitudes. And that lower angle means that a greater area is covered by the same ray of sun. And then the other thing that's the more important thing in terms of the global annual energy balance is the fact that the pole of rotation of the Earth, so this is the North Pole and the South Pole, that pole is tilted 23.5 degrees relative to perpendicular to the plane of the orbit of the Earth around the sun. So if we look at this ridiculously not to scale diagram where we have a teeny little sun here in the middle and big Earth circulating around it, but it has the right sense in terms of the light from the sun on the side of the ball. You can see that in July, that last section, last example that I showed you, the North Pole is pointed relatively towards the sun. In September and March, neither the North or South Pole is pointed towards or away from the sun. And this is you'll remember, these are the times of the year where the day and night are about the same length. And then when you go to December, the North Pole is pointed away from the sun and it's light all the time in the South Pole. So let me just go through a little tour of sun and shadow that kind of I hope brings this home to you. The first time I saw a map like this was my first trip to Australia, and that's a very long trip, and I don't remember what airline I was on, but this was the map that they showed to indicate your progress going from Los Angeles to Sydney, not me, the city. But anyway, so I saw this for a really long time. That is a very, very, very long trip. And so I saw the shadow and sunline change over the course of the day quite a lot. So I've cut out these little cartoons from the orbit of the Earth around the sun to indicate what time of the year I'm dealing with here. So this is midnight in New York City, March 21, so the spring equinox. New York City, Miami, Panama, for your reference. And you can see that it's the boundary between shadow and sun is approximately oriented north-south. In other words, it would be following time zones. If we move on to the summer, northern hemisphere summer, that is, June 21, the North Pole is pointed towards the sun. And you can see that, you can think of this as time going from left to right across the map. And you can see that it's light all day long in the North Pole, and it's dark all day long in the South Pole. And if you move to midnight, September 21, so the autumn equinox, you can see again the sun and shadow lines are oriented north-south. And if you move to December, you can see that it's dark all day long in the North Pole and light all day long in the South Pole. So if we look at this, all four of them together, and then we keep in mind that the rotation of the Earth is constant, and so therefore a distance on the map can be taken as a proxy for time, you can see that in the tropics around the equator, this is all the same line, you can see that the length of day and night is equal in the four seasons, but you can also see that it's very very large contrast in the northern hemisphere summer and northern hemisphere winter, and conversely in the southern hemisphere. Okay, so the tilt of the Earth so the Earth rotates once a day, and the Earth orbits about the Sun once a year, and the tilt of the Earth is a really important factor in governing the uneven distribution of heat on the surface of the Earth. But in addition to this, If you look at the distance between the sun and the Earth in the northern hemisphere winter, and I take that same line and compare it to the northern hemisphere summer, you can see that the distance from between the Earth and the Sun is slightly greater in the northern hemisphere summer. And this has a subtracting effect, right? So the greater the distance, the less the energy. And so in the summer, it's less hot than it would be because of the greater distance compared to the winter time. And so that means that today, in today's situation, the northern hemisphere has less extreme differences between summer and winter than the southern hemisphere does. Not taking into account the fact that most of the continents are in the north, and this has a different effect. But over time, I'm not going to be talking about Milankovitch theory here, but over time, the conditions that hold a day about the Earth's orbit about the Sun have not been constant. And astronomers are able to calculate what those conditions have been back in the past and into the future, and so they're able to estimate what the amount of incoming radiation from the Sun would be at any spot on Earth at any time during the past for the last several million years. Okay, so we've talked about the fact that the Sun's the energy and it's not evenly distributed. And now I want to talk about what the climate system responses and feedbacks are to that. So in order to do that, we've got to take into account how the Sun's radiation can be treated by Earth. And so we have three hypothetical flashlights here shining radiation, maybe of different wavelengths, onto three little test atmosphere boxes. So in the first atmosphere box, the source, let's call it visible light, comes, intercepts the box, is not impeded at all, doesn't interact, and passes right through. That's called transmission. In the second flashlight, let's call it infrared radiation, the light arrives at the atmosphere and is completely absorbed by the gases in the atmosphere, and so you don't see the arrow coming out the other side of the box. And in the third case, the light, doesn't really matter what kind it is, let's call it visible light just for fun, intercepts the atmosphere and then reflects back out into space. Okay, so let's look at what that is in terms of the real Earth system processes. So this is a chart that you may be familiar with from the astronomy section. This is wavelength of energy on the x-axis with the log scale 0.1, 1, 10, 100, and absorption on the y-axis from 0% absorption to 100. And if you'll remember, the context in which you learned this in the astronomy section was asking the question, can we make observations of objects of this wavelength from the Earth's surface, or must we go into orbit in order to see those? And the answer is, if the absorption is low, you can see it from Earth, and if the absorption is high, then you have to get out of the atmosphere. So the Sun's peak radiation is at about 0.7 micrometers, and that is a part of the Earth's atmosphere where the absorption is quite low, so we can see the Sun. You'll be glad to know that I informed you about that. And then, in contrast, the peak wavelength that's being emitted by the Earth is infrared, about 17 micrometers. And at that wavelength, there's actually quite a lot of absorption of that kind of energy by the Earth's atmosphere. And so this is the greenhouse effect. And another way of stating this important observation is that Earth's atmosphere is nearly transparent to incoming Sun's radiation, and it's nearly opaque to outgoing Earth's radiation. And that's an important aspect of the global energy balance. And then the third possible reaction between radiation and the atmosphere that I talked about was reflectivity. And the Earth's reflectivity has a total of about 35%. So in other words, 35% of the radiation that could be received by the Earth is instead reflected back out into space and doesn't act to warm the Earth. So this is a photograph or an image from space of the Earth. Here's Africa in the foreground. And you can see a lot of white clouds here. And clouds make up a very large fraction of the reflectance from the Earth's surface back into space. And another fairly substantial fraction is actually scattering from the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is a big factor in reflecting energy back away from the Sun, from the Earth's surface back out into space. So if we go back to our cartoon, the source of light, the Sun's light, visible light, passes through the atmosphere relatively unimpeded. There's some interactions, and some of them are very important. Earth's radiation is strongly absorbed by our atmosphere, and clouds reflect sunlight back out into space. Okay, so if we look at this on Wally Broker's model or cartoon energy budget diagram, clouds and atmospheric scattering reflect light back out into space. White aerosols, remember he talked about the fact that white and black aerosols have different effects on the reflection versus absorption, and that there are natural and man-made sources of aerosols. And it's actually one of the frontiers of science, is to actually understand the role of aerosols in the climate system. But anyway, white aerosols tend to reflect light back out into space. And if the sunlight penetrates to the surface of the Earth, reflective materials on the surface of the Earth will also act to cool the surface by reflecting the radiation back out into space. And so ice is particularly important in that regard. Okay, and then the other aspect is the greenhouse gases. So here's our sun's rays shining into the Earth. It warms it up, and the radiation, the little squiggly red lines going back out, is the Earth's radiation going back out. It gets absorbed by greenhouse gases. This is the GG star, greenhouse gases. And it gets absorbed, and then it's radiated in all directions, which is what the arrows going in all directions is supposed to indicate. And you'll notice on here that he's highlighted water by making it a different color and putting an asterisk by it. Water vapor is the most important greenhouse gas in the Earth's atmosphere. These other compounds of the Earth's atmosphere are also important greenhouse gases, and it's particularly relevant and important to us that carbon dioxide is an important greenhouse gas, because we're actually increasing the carbon dioxide concentration of the atmosphere with fossil fuel burning. But water is extremely important in the climate system, and it's not necessarily simply important in the climate system. So here's a little cartoon demonstrating that. So here's our globe. So Africa, Europe, North America, South America. And the yellow lines are the sun's radiation coming to the surface of the Earth. And the red lines are the Earth's radiation going back out into space. And the white things that look like clouds are clouds. And the sort of transparent gray stuff is the water vapor, right? So the way this works is if the rays come to and strike a cloud, they're going to reflect back out into space. But if the rays come and absorb on the Earth, and the Earth's radiation radiates them back out, they're going to get trapped by our atmosphere. So water vapor has the dual effect of either warming as a water vapor or cooling as a result of forming clouds that are highly reflective. Okay, so there's a series of these maps that I'm going to show today, and these all come from this same website, this geography website from the University of Oregon. And I strongly encourage you to explore your curiosity and look at those. It's like the advertisement where, I can't think of the little boy's name, but the teacher says to the parents, I want Jimmy to do his video game, because this is probably the best way that you can gain an intuition for exactly what's happening in the climate system. So this first set of maps, so what this is going to do, and you can barely see the months, so you have to squint to see the months. If you look at it on the website, the text is actually very clear. And I've kind of added the text to indicate the things that I think are essential to get the picture here. But it's cycling through the months, August, September, and so forth. And the top left map here is the shortwave radiation. The bottom left map is the longwave radiation. And the right-hand map is the net radiation. And the way these are constructed is they take into account the amount coming down minus the amount going back up, right? So in the case of the shortwave radiation, which essentially would be sun's radiation, that's going to be a positive number. So everything in the yellows and oranges is positive numbers, and they go from 0 to 200 watts per meter squared. And if it's being directed up from the Earth, such as the infrared radiation that the Earth is radiating back, it's going to be a negative number, and that's what these blues are here. And that goes from 0 to 100 watts per meter squared. And then the net has the same concept. It's the total amount coming down minus the total amount coming back up. And so you can see that through the course of the year that, in general, it's always warmer in the tropics, and that the northern hemisphere gets warmer in the summer, northern hemisphere summer months, and it gets colder in the northern hemisphere winter months, while the southern hemisphere is getting warmer, or getting more energy, I should say. So this is actually the warmth. That was the energy, and this is the temperature. So this is the air temperature, and here the extremes, the sort of blues and purples, are very cold, and the yellows and reds are hotter. And so the extreme cold down here in Antarctica, the purple is less than minus 50 degrees, and the bright orange here, the hots, are greater than 35 degrees. And the month, again, is shown up here in the right-hand side. And you can see that it's warmer in the tropics than it is at the poles. And you can see that it gets warmer in the northern hemisphere summer, and conversely, in the southern hemisphere summer. But you can also see that these lines of temperature are not exactly lined up according to latitude. And that has to do with the redistribution of energy in the climate system, which we'll get back to in a little while. Okay, so We've talked about the global energy balance, and we've generally talked about the factors, the reflection feedback and the absorption feedback. But I want to go into a little bit more detail to try to help you construct an intuitive model that you can use to ask yourself questions about how the energy balance in the atmosphere works. And you're going to be doing this kind of exercise to increase your intuition during the seminars in the next week or so, depending on your schedule. So these diagrams make me dizzy as well. So if you're feeling dizzy, don't worry about it. But sort of just look at it. Just take a couple of minutes to look at it. So the yellow arrow here is the sun energy coming in. And this is a real-life estimation from a science paper. The amount of energy coming in, some of it is actually absorbed on the surface. Some of it is reflected back out into space by the clouds. Some of it gets to the surface but gets reflected back by the reflection at the surface, such as ice and so forth. And then some of it is actually absorbed by the atmosphere. That's an interesting story of its own that we haven't really talked about and won't, but I can answer a question if you want. And then from the Earth's radiation back out into space, much of it gets trapped by the atmosphere. You notice that it's not 100% absorption across the whole range of the Earth's radiation. So some of it, and that's called the atmospheric window, actually does get back out into space. And then some of it, the part that gets absorbed into the atmosphere, gets re-radiated back down to the surface of the Earth. So what we want to know, we want to do these really simple calculations to give ourselves a sense of the energy balance in the climate system. And so we really care about how much energy is coming in, and we care about how much energy is making it in, right? So the part that's not reflected back out into space. And we care about the amount of energy that's going back out and the amount of energy that's retained in the atmosphere. And when steady state is achieved, that is an equilibrium, a balance where the system is steady, the amount of energy, the atmospheric balance, is equal to the amount of energy going back out. So this might seem kind of complicated at first, but bear with me for a little bit. This would be, I think, what Don Hood would call a choice point. So we're going to iterate. And this is the watts per meter square, EN coming in. And this may look like a dashed line, but it's actually not a dashed line. These are the iterations. So you can see that for every iteration, it's constant. The amount of energy coming in is the same thing. And we've given ourselves a 35% reflectance. And so the amount of energy that's really coming in is the amount of energy in times 1 minus the amount that's reflected back. And when steady state is achieved, that means that that energy out is going to be equal to that same value. Okay, so this is the result of the iterative calculations. So to start out with, you can see, let me just give you the parameters. We're starting with the EN is equal to 278 watts per meter squared. 35% of that is not getting to the surface because it's reflecting back out into space. And then we're re-radiating 32% of that. So we're absorbing the rest of it in the atmosphere. And you can see that I have a lot of digits on this F for the part that's re-radiated. And that's because I was attempting to create a balance that comes out with the temperature of the Earth, ignoring water vapor changes and so forth, just a temperature balance. Okay, and so these are only, I showed you the balance of the various factors coming in and going out. This one is actually not on that graph, but this is important for accounting to take care of the energy balance. So the energy going out, the one that was pointed out at the ground there, is this one, and the atmospheric balance is this one here, and then the total is the amount before the amount going out leads to the balance at the end. And so this is the EN 278 and the EN times 0.65. And what we really want to know is this atmospheric balance and what's required to know that we've got a condition that's in steady state is that this EN times 0.65 is equal to the E out. So that you can see over here at about 15 iterations, I started with a zero energy at the surface of the Earth, and so I basically just kept adding a constant amount of energy until the atmosphere warmed up enough that the amount of energy that was being radiated back out to space was equal to the amount of energy that was coming in. So this condition where these all become horizontal lines is a steady state, and the important thing is that in that case, the amount of energy coming in is equal to the amount of energy going out. Okay, so let's think about this in terms of the Earth's global climate. So our actual temperature is 15 degrees centigrade. And the estimate of the temperature that would be achieved at the surface of the Earth based on the distance between the Sun and the Earth only is only 5 degrees centigrade, 10 degrees cooler than that. And if we take into account that 35% of that energy is actually being reflected back out into space, that would be even lower, minus 23 degrees centigrade, very cold. And that means that the atmosphere, the greenhouse effect of the atmosphere, actually adds substantial warmth to the Earth. And so it has to add about 38 degrees to get to this 15 degrees that we know the temperature to be. And that means that, effectively, it means that Earth is habitable due to the greenhouse gases in its atmosphere. So greenhouse gases are a good thing. It's just that the balance between the greenhouse gases and reflection are very delicate, and so we have to be concerned about adding to the greenhouse effect. So to recap, the Earth is 150 million kilometers from the Sun. It has 35% of the energy is reflected back out into space, and the surface temperature on the Earth is 15 degrees, or 59 degrees Fahrenheit. So if we compare this to Venus, Venus is closer to the Earth, to the Sun. It's 0.723 times the Earth-Sun distance. Its reflectance is huge. It reflects 75% of the Sun's radiation back out into space. But despite that, its surface temperature is 467 degrees centigrade. This is really hot. This is hot enough to melt lead. So let's look at this in another way. So if we look at this distance on the x-axis in millions of kilometers away from the Sun, versus the temperature that would be predicted simply based on the distance from the Sun. The Earth is 150 million kilometers away from the Sun, and the temperature that it would have based on just absorbing all the Sun's radiation, no atmosphere and reflectance interaction, would be 5 degrees centigrade. And for reference, the boiling point of water is 100 and the freezing point is 0. If we compare that to Venus's real temperature versus the actual versus the calculated temperature, we would calculate a temperature of Venus that's a little bit more than 50 degrees centigrade, and yet the real temperature is greater than 467 degrees, or is about 467 degrees. And to scale this, if you put 467 on here, it would be about as far above this graph as the thickness of the graph is. So this is very hot and extremely different than what would be predicted just based on distance alone. You might be interested to know that Venus and Earth have about the same chemical composition, including their carbon, but the carbon in Venus is only in the atmosphere. Venus's atmosphere has about 90 atmosphere pressure, and it's virtually all carbon dioxide. And in contrast, you'll remember from the carbon balance exercises that you've done that the Earth's carbon, very, very small fraction of the carbon from the Earth is actually in the atmosphere. So the Earth has one atmosphere, atmospheric pressure, and of that, 380 parts per million, even after the anthropogenic adding, is the CO2. And this is the contrast between the extraordinarily high temperatures of Venus compared to Earth. Okay, so the next thing I want to get to is conditions related to the feedback in the Earth's climate system. And I'm going to give two examples of feedbacks, and they're both going to be reflection feedbacks. One of them is going to be negative, and the other one is going to be positive. And I just want to give you a physical example of positive and negative feedbacks. So if you take a ball and you go to the top of a hill and you push the ball is going to continue to roll down the hill till it gets to the bottom. But and that's a positive feedback because it kept going, it went more than the force you put on it in the first place. However, if you go to the bottom of the hill with the same ball and you push it up, as soon as you quit pushing, the ball is going to come back down to you. So that's acting in the opposite sense of your initial push, and that would be an example of a negative feedback. So this example I have here is a negative feedback. That's a case where the initial climate response is reduced by the reaction to that climate response. And so let's take this scenario, which is actually in your habits text. The initial response might be warming due to increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That increased warming might lead to greater evaporation of water vapor. The greater evaporation leads to greater cloud cover, and we've just seen that clouds are a very important part of the reflection of the Earth of energy away from the Earth, and so therefore clouds reflect sun back, light back, leading to cooling, and that's opposite the initial climate forcing. So in this case of a positive feedback, the climate cools. As a result of the cooler climate, snow and ice are able to preserved longer, and snow and ice have high reflectivity, and so therefore more of the energy from the sun is reflected back out into space, and that leads to greater cooling, and so therefore this is a positive feedback. Okay, so let's use what we've learned about energy balances to try to understand what the effect of feedback is in the climate system. So if you'll remember, we went through 30 iterations before using the energy in as 278, and all I'm plotted here is the thing I said we cared about, the atmospheric balance energy. So we got to equilibrium at 15 or so, and then we continued on to 30, and I decided to make a small change in the amount of energy coming in and see what that does to the climate system. And you can see that you decrease the energy by 2%, so from 278 to 272. And you can see that after a couple or three iterations, the system has equilibrated and is at a lower value, which is also the 2% lower than the radiation coming in. So in the first case, I want to look at the feedback rule number one, is that for every 1 watt per meter squared that I lose as a result of this reduced incoming radiation, I'm going to increase the reflectance by 0.1%. So A is albedo. That's the technical word for reflectance. So if you'll remember, okay, so this is six watts per meter squared less energy coming in. And so that means that it's going to be 0.6% greater reflectance than it was before I did this. And the reflectance we're using to start with, this whole calculation was based on 35% reflectance. So it's going to go up to 35.6% reflectance. And the red line here is the response to that. So you can see that it takes longer for the iterate to get back to equilibrium, and the ultimate condition that it gets to is a lower energy received at the surface of the Earth than it would be without a feedback, right? So this is the same amount of energy, but the amount that's stored in the atmosphere is lower than it would be without the feedback. So the second rule is, the feedback rule is that for every 1 watt per meter squared of energy loss, I'm going to increase the reflectance by 0.2%. So do you have a feeling for what that's going to do to the energy balance? It's probably going to decrease it, right? I surprised myself with this result, actually. So it means that you're going to, for everyone, instead of increasing the albedo to 35.6, you're going to increase it to 36.2. For that first step, and that leads to what we call a runaway albedo effect, which I thought was very fascinating that I formed my own runaway albedo effect. We actually have examples on Earth in the distant past, around 600 or 700 million years ago. There's a couple of times in Earth history where it appears that something like this may have taken place and actually caused the Earth to have a snowball effect. But anyway, you might be asking yourself, I did, what's the in-between? Where does it go from being kind of simple, just goes to a lower energy, but it's balanced, to being this falling off the face of the Earth? This is 0 watts per meter squared, no energy entering the Earth system. And I stopped the iteration when the reflection would have been greater than 100%, because you can't reflect more than you get. Okay, so the feedback rule number three is going to be that for every 1 watt per meter squared of energy loss, we're going to increase reflection by 0.17%. And in that case, you would probably have to iterate for a really long time to find out whether it's going to reach a steady state or not. It certainly hasn't yet. Maybe it's starting to kind of turn over a little bit, but it's certainly going to end up at a much, much lower energy than what would be predicted simply from the amount of energy that's coming in, or the reduced energy that's coming in. So this is the example of the angry climate beast kicking in to greatly increase the impact of a small change in the energy forcing of the climate system. So just to recap, the black line is where there's no feedback and the system just reaches equilibrium. The red line is where I increase the reflectance by 0.1% for each watt per meter squared loss. The blue line is by 1.17% for each watt per meter squared lost. And the green line is by 0.2% for each watt per meter lost. Okay, so the take-home message is that the important climate feedbacks are reflection and absorption. And within the climate system, the really important components that contribute to those feedbacks are the state of H2O, whether it's ice, water, or gas, and where carbon is in the Earth system. So I'll take questions.
I've got one here. Hi. You were saying that the water can act as a cloud and reflect the sunlight, and that water can also act as a greenhouse gas and absorb the light. What's the ratio between the two? I mean, is one effect greater than the other, and do you guys expect that to change in the near future?
That's a really excellent question, and it's actually at the frontier of climate dynamic research. I mean, you can answer the question fairly simply. Neither one of them is going away, right? Both of them are happening, but the balance of that is actually very difficult to predict. And you may be surprised to know that it's not thoroughly understood how clouds form in the first place. And so, actually, understanding how clouds form is going to be essential to really really being able to get to the answer to that question. And different types of clouds have different responses. So the clouds themselves act to reflect Earth's radiation back to Earth as well. So there's a blanketing effect. You probably noticed if it's a cold but cloudy day, it feels warmer than if it's a real cold, crisp day in the wintertime. And that's the effect of the clouds actually re-radiating or reflecting Earth's radiation back. So there's multiple effects that act on that, and I can't give you, I'm not trying to be evasive, but I can't give you a simple answer. But it brings me to reminiscing about what Wally Broker was talking about in the context of moving water around in the Earth system, right? So when climate changes, it actually shifts the locus of where it's more rainy and more evaporation is happening, so that you can actually change the balance on a regional scale. You can change that, and regional changes in those dynamics actually feed back to the global system. And so it's one of those things sort of like the in-body problem where it requires numerical simulations to attempt to answer that question simply. No? Okay, so the next thing I'm going to talk about the climate system is the circulation or the redistribution of that uneven heating from the sun. And so this cartoon sort of sets the stage to show that. This is a part of the globe, South America, Central America here, and the yellow arrow here is the sun's energy coming into the surface of the Earth. And the sun's energy comes in, it warms up the surface, and that warms up the air. Warm air collects more water vapor, and it rises, and it loses its capacity to carry that water vapor, and so it forms clouds. In addition to that, as the warm air rises, it creates a vacuum that airs from north and south of the equator move to fill in. And that, plus the fact that the Earth is rotating, is what produces the southeast and northeast trade winds. So if you look at this image from space, so this is about the same location, South America, Central America, you can see that indeed there's a greater cloud cover in this region where there's the updraft from the greater heating from the sun. And this is this area where the greater cloud cover is called the intertropical convergence zone. So this is one of those maps from the Oregon University of Oregon website again. And here this is the colors are coded for the sea level pressure, and low is in the blues, and the lowest value is 95 millibars, and the highs are in the yellows, and the highest is 1,025 millibars. And the arrows that are on this map indicate the direction. The direction of the arrow indicates the direction of the wind, and the length of the arrow. The stronger the wind, the greater the length of the arrow. So you can see here that in this region that I just showed you around South America, that is a relatively low pressure along here compared to the regions to the north and south of that. And you can also see that the arrows tend to point from the southeast and from the northeast, with the exception of some seasons in the Indian Ocean, which is an interesting story of its own. And you can see that the tropics is not the only place where there's a boundary between high and low pressure. There's a belt called the westerlies. You can see the arrows all flowing from west to east at here and along here at 40 degrees. And then just to the south of there, there's another area of low pressure and then an area of high pressure at the poles. So these areas of low and high pressure, winds blow from high to low pressure. And these areas of high and low pressure are driven by changes in the convection or the moving up and moving down of the air masses in response to the uneven heating. Okay? And so the atmospheric circulation forms winds, it forms clouds, and it moves water around. And this next two maps I'm going to show are indicating the way water is moved around in the climate system. So this is precipitation, and low is in the light blue colors, less than 10 millimeters, and high is in the dark blue colors, greater than 400 millimeters. And so you can see this belt of high rainfall. Here's Panama. You can see this belt of high rainfall across the tropics. You can see the belt of very low rainfall on either side of the tropics. And you can probably also notice right away that it's not homogeneous around a single latitude. You can see that this is especially dry and this is wet, especially dry and wet. So on the east sides of these ocean basins, especially dry, and on the west side, it's wet. That's because of the positions of the continents and the interactions between the atmospheric circulation and the continents. And then if we look at the precipitation minus the evaporation, gives us a sense of how much water is available in a particular place. And this is really important in places where, in arid lands, where water usage is an extremely important political issue. This is the dry areas have negative, there's more evaporation than there is precipitation, and wet areas are positive, or there's more precipitation than there is evaporation. And the brown and yellow colors are dry, and the green colors are wet. So again, you can see that it's wet in the tropics, and it's dry in these belts on either side of the tropics. And this redistribution of water is one of the things that might change dramatically with changing climate. Okay, so the atmosphere redistributes energy with the winds, it forms clouds, it moves water, and all these things are important in the climate system, but it also affects the ocean circulation. So the ocean circulation can be divided up into sort of two interacting components, which are the surface or wind-driven circulation and the deep or great ocean conveyor or density-driven circulation. So this map is an example of one of the frontiers in climate science. And what this map is a representation of the velocity of currents at 15 meters in the ocean in meters per second. And it's color-coded. The continents are green here. And it's color-coded according to what the velocity is, so that low velocities are zero, are in these dark colors, and that high velocities are in these light yellow and white colors. So if you just look at this map, I want to point out a couple of things. One of them is that one of the aspects of the frontier here is how they dealt with the geography. Remember, I pointed out that the South Pole doesn't take very long to go all around the Earth at the South Pole. So that represents a complexity when you go to deal with geometrical calculations. And so they basically cut up the Earth and made it a long, skinny map like that. So this is Antarctica, Greenland, Siberia. And this is Africa, Australia, Asia. What the movie's going to do that I'm about to show you is it's going to take the sides of this box and put it together and make a cube, and then it's going to morph the cube into a sphere, and you're going to be able to see on the spherical globe what the surface currents are doing, and these currents are, again, in response to the driving winds. Okay, and then the other thing I want to make sure I point out here is that you can see some areas with extremely high velocities. So this one right here is the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, is the strongest current system in the world. And you can also see these really strong light yellow colors all along the tropics, particularly in the Indian Ocean. And then the other thing that's really important to note here is that the light colors are strongly concentrated along the western boundaries of the oceans. And on the eastern boundaries of the oceans, there's much less of this high velocity. So this is called the western boundary currents or western boundary intensification, and it's related to the fact that the Earth is rotating. But the other thing that I really want to point out before I show the movie is I want you to specifically notice what's going on in the context of the Gulf Stream. So everybody's probably familiar with the Gulf Stream, but you'll be able to watch this current. It's sort of moving through the tropics, up along the coast of South America, up along North America, and then going out along here, Norway along here. So Greenland and Norway. And you can see the velocity going all the way up into this Greenland-Norwegian Sea. And that's the heat source. That's the Gulf Stream heat source that we keep talking about, this big water-to-air heat pump that's bringing heat up into the northern latitudes. Okay, so let's watch this movie. So the sides of the box are just going to close up now. Why is that happening to me? That's not supposed to happen. Hopefully, it'll run this time. So the sides of the box are closing up. Now it's forming a cube. Now you can see the sides of the edges of the cube are starting to kind of round off. It's making a sphere out of the cube. This is called cube sphere. Here's the Arctic Ocean. You can see Greenland. You can see Alaska, India, Africa. Look at this huge cauldron of currents flowing and intersecting the coast of Africa and going down along there. This one of my favorite research areas is the Agulhas Current, which is this current you can see going down along the coast of Africa. Look at this strong currents coming from across the Atlantic Ocean, up along the coast of South America, up along the coast of North America, going up into the Nordic Seas. That's basically the Gulf Stream system that's bringing this extra warmth into the northern hemisphere. And notice that in general, along the tropics, there's high velocities as a result of this interaction, this upwelling, the intertropical convergence zone, the trade winds, and the response to that in the ocean. And then again, here's this big Antarctic circumpolar current. Notice when these current, the position of the continents is really important in driving where the currents are. And you can actually see when these currents intersect one of the continents, you can see the currents just sort of spinning off and producing all these giant eddies. So this is the Indonesian through flow. It's going to be a really important passage of Pacific waters, deep, warm Pacific waters into the Indian Ocean. And the Indian Ocean is just a cauldron of activity in terms of these ocean currents. And then you can see this Agulhas Current coming down along the coast of Africa and then retroflecting into the Antarctic circumpolar system. You can see eddies moving into the Atlantic Ocean. And those eddies are considered to be really important for bringing heat and salt from the Indian Ocean into the Atlantic Ocean and potentially feeding back all the way up into the North Atlantic deep water formation. So now the sphere went back into a box, and the box is opening up, and you see a map. And the thing that I'm going to call your attention to for the purposes of bridging to deep water circulation is the fact that this Gulf Stream system is bringing warm, salty water up into the... You can't tell it's salty from here, but it's bringing warm water up into the Nordic Seas. Okay, so this is the Great Ocean Conveyor Belt, that cartoon that Wally Broker designed and showed last time. And the Great Ocean Conveyor Belt can be thought of as a giant water-to-air heat pump. So when we were graduate students, my husband actually rebuilt the house that we lived. We bought a house that was a summer cottage that only had an outdoor shower. And so he rebuilt it. And one of the things that he did was to install a water-to-air heat pump. And the way it worked in our house was that we had a well that provided water. And the water has a constant temperature through the year, about 50 degrees. And so you take a very teeny amount of that heat out of the water, extract that, and that heats your house, or you add water from your house, and it cools it in the summer. And then that water gets sent into, in our case, we put it back down into the ground, into a gravel pit, an underground gravel pit that we had dug. And that was an extremely energy efficient, which, by the way, is relevant for this kind of lecture as well, I guess. It was an extremely energy efficient way, but it's also this is the sort of Gary-made analog for the natural system, which is a giant water-to-air heat pump. So this warm water from the tropics and subtropics moves up into the region between Greenland and Norway, and the water loses its energy to the atmosphere, thereby warming the atmosphere over those areas. And so it's a really important factor, at least in the climate of those regions. And so the situation is that the cold, salty water is sinking there, and that's actually driving there to be more. It's not just a circulation of the northern hemisphere water. It's actually dragging some of the warmth from the southern hemisphere into the northern hemisphere along that Gulf Stream. And then in addition to that, there's extra cold water forming in the southern ocean. You might find this interesting. I found it fascinating that if you look at the surface of the ocean, I've already showed you that the temperature at the surface of the ocean responds is basically parallel to latitude bands because of the uneven heating from the sun. If you look at the temperature of the water in the deep ocean, below 1,000 meters in the ocean, there's no water that's warmer than 4 centimeters. It's all almost freezing. And that's because the last time that water was at the surface of the Earth, It was in the polar region. So these are the regions where the deep waters of the world's ocean are less at the surface. They get dense as a result of this cooling. They go down into the deep abyss, and they fill the deep ocean basin. Okay, and then you may be familiar with this set of slides. This is a cartoon of the currents in the North Atlantic, and we have this recirculating current here. We also have the Gulf Stream, part of the Gulf Stream moving up in between Norway and Greenland, bringing warm water. And that's the reason that these temperature contours are deflected so that they're not parallel to latitude, that they're oriented northeast, southwest. And so I put two arrows on here to guide your eye to the comparison between this movement of water in the North Atlantic and this movement of the warm water up along the coast of Norway. And then in the last glacial times, when ice was covering New York City and Long Island was being formed as a terminal moraine, the temperatures were much lower in this North Atlantic region. So unfortunately, this color scale is different, but I've highlighted the 18-degree and 12-degree contours here, and I've made these the same scale and lined them up at the same latitude so that you can see that the temperature for the same temperatures moved south in the last glacial maximum compared to today. And in addition to that, the distribution of temperature, there's still a little bit more warmth in the east than there is in the west. So in that time, the Gulf Stream was not completely isolated from Norway, but it's greatly reduced, and the temperatures are moved to the south during that time. Okay, and then if we just look at the net effect of atmosphere and ocean circulation, this is, to start with, this is a plot of latitude from 80 south to 80 north, and the latitudes are squeezed at the high end to make the area under the curve be proportional to the area on the surface of the globe that would have this characteristic. And so this is the amount of energy received on the y-axis, or the amount of energy on the y-axis in this case received. And you can see that there's more received in the tropics than there is in the poles. But if we compare this, and this is averaged over any latitude, it's averaged all around the longitude, so we call that a zonal average. And the average that's coming in is about here, taking into account the 35% reflectance. Then if we compare that to the outgoing radiation, which is this red line, you can see that there's more going out in the high latitudes than there is coming in. And in contrast, there's less going out in the tropics than there is coming in. But remember that on the global average, the amount coming in equals the amount going out. And so the area under these two curves is equal to each other. And that is that is in a nutshell the effect of the atmosphere and ocean circulation redistributing the energy. It makes it a less extreme difference between the tropics and the poles than it would be without that. Okay, so what regulates climate? Well, it's the sun, energy, and so the distance from the sun is important. The fact that the heating is uneven is important. Climate system feedbacks and responses are extremely important. So the energy balance responses, the reflection feedback and the absorption feedback can have a big impact on the energy balance. And in addition to that, the redistribution of the energy by atmosphere and ocean circulation can be extremely important in the climate system. So if we just sort of take what we've learned today to try to revisit Wally Broker's lesson about the Younger Dryas, I've converted the oxygen isotopes to annual temperature average. That's the proxy versus age in thousands of years. And you'll notice that there are these very large oscillations in the temperature. So this scale is 16 degrees for reference. So in the last 10,000 years, the temperature has been warmer and relatively unchanging. But right before that, there was this big oscillation in temperature of the Younger Dryas. And just the presence of these very large changes that I can tell you without showing you right now are way disproportionate to the forcing that could have gone into to producing these. By themselves, they imply that there must be substantial feedbacks in the climate system. And so the area time of the Younger Dryas, it was coming out of the glacial, got warmer, and then we had a sudden return to cold conditions and then a return to the warm conditions. And I want to point out that this record from Greenland, this ice core record from Greenland, was collected back in the 80s. And this is the record that caused Wally Broker and climate scientists like Wally Broker to become concerned about global warming. It was this record that made them realize that it's not just a simple little global energy balance and you can just calculate it very simply. If you take into account, these were unpredicted at the time. The fact that you could have such large reactions to climate forcing was completely unpredicted before this Greenland ice core record came to be. And so this has driven And the other thing, that the transitions between these are extremely fast. These things happen on congressional timescales. And so it didn't escape the notice of the scientists that this was a funding opportunity as well, right? Because if it's going to happen slowly, and maybe it's going to happen in your grandchild's generation, then it's not going to help whether you're going to get votes or not, right? But if it's going to happen on your timescale, then it really matters if you react to whether climate's changing or not. And so the scientists didn't ignore the fact that this was a funding opportunity. So you'll remember that Wally hypothesized that the explanation, the feedback that he hypothesized for the Younger Dryas was that the Great Ocean Conveyor shut down. In other words, that warm, salty water going up between Greenland and Norway no longer went up there. And as a result of that, the heat from that didn't go up there, and so it cooled down dramatically. And so in order to sort of follow this line of reasoning, you have to remember that salty water is denser. I didn't say that, but it's true. And that there's a lot of ice up here in North America during the last glacial, and there was still a lot. It was melting away, but there was still a lot of ice left at the time of the Younger Dryas. And adding this fresh water to the North Atlantic would add fresh water and therefore lower the density and make it less likely that deep water could form, and thereby, in this hypothesis, shut down the deep ocean conveyor. So cold, salty water sinks normally. Cold, fresher water may fail to sink, in other words, not transport the heat. And the feedback is that the cooling from that might lead to the greater formation of sea ice. Also, the fresher water freezes more easily as well. So both those things could lead to a feedback to forming more sea ice. And he also showed that there was this evidence from the North Atlantic. It comes from the ice cores, marine sediment cores, and on-land evidence in Europe that there was a much greater extent of sea ice in the Younger Dryas. So this is a map showing the that Wally Broker already showed you, showing the winter distribution in today's winters. And then this is the comparison from the Younger Dryas. So you can see this is a whopping increase in the amount of sea ice in the North Atlantic region. So here's Greenland, Iceland, and here's Great Britain. Remember that, you know, there's palm trees growing in Great Britain as a result of the Gulf Stream coming in and warming things up. So they wouldn't be very happy in this time of the Younger Dryas. Okay, so sea ice has a really high reflectivity, and this would be a positive feedback for cooling. Sea ice also does, it basically reflects the energy, and the energy that it doesn't reflect goes towards melting the ice, and so the temperature on top of sea ice can be extreme, can be much lower than freezing, whereas the temperature is constrained to be freezing or higher when there's open water. And so it's much milder when there's water than when there's sea ice. In addition to that, the sea ice actually blocks the movement of the warm Gulf Stream waters up into the passage between Greenland and Europe, and this is also going to be a positive feedback to cooling. Okay, so in summary, what regulates climate is global energy balance. That global energy is unevenly distributed on the Earth, and the climate system responses and feedbacks include the reflection and absorption feedbacks, and in addition to that, the atmosphere and oceans act to redistribute the heat and make the differences less between the poles and the equator. So thank you.